Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, April 15th, 2019, and I'm Cara Santa Maria. I'm really excited about this week's episode, but before we dive in, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week by supporting the show at patreon.com/talknerdy. The top supporters this week are Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil Tiber, the Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you all so very much. If you're interested in supporting the show, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy, or you can go to talknerdymerch.com to buy some, what do you think, Talk Nerdy merch. And that definitely goes to support the show as well. You could also rate and review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get podcasts. And I don't know, share the love on social media with some people that you know. Always excited, I don't know which it is, whenever I find out that more people have heard about the show. I think we are small yet mighty, and I'm really, really pumped about this week's episode. So I had the chance to sit down with Dr. Stacy Finley. So she's an associate professor of biomedical engineering, chemical engineering, and materials science and biological sciences. She's definitely in a multidisciplinary field in the USC, which is the University of Southern California's Viterbi School of Engineering. So she actually runs the computational systems biology laboratory at USC. And in this laboratory, they look at all sorts of mechanistic models of biological processes. So they use these computational models to learn how biological systems are regulated, to understand clinical observations, to test different hypotheses, and to, you know, develop novel therapeutics. And one of the areas that they're really focused on right now is cancer biology. But of course, she can tell you all of this much better than I ever could. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Stacy Finley. Well, Stacy, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks. This is really exciting.
All right. So I say this every time I have somebody in studio, but it's because it's always true. It's a totally different vibe for me to be able to have someone in studio. Early on when I was starting the podcast, I almost always did my episodes live. But then as I've been doing it for so many years and reaching out to people across the globe, I do a lot of them remotely. And as much as it's, you know, amazing that we have the type of, what do you call it, the type of technology that allows us to do that now, there's always something missing when you can't look at somebody in the eyes.
Yeah, I agree. So I'm excited to sit with you and have a conversation.
Yeah. And the reason that we're lucky enough to be able to do that is because you are a local researcher here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. You actually are at the University of Southern California, mm-hmm. USC. Are you native Angeleno, or did you move here for the job?
I moved here for the job. And actually, with academic life and that career, I've been lots of places. So I'm actually originally from Kansas City, Kansas.
Oh.
And then I did my undergraduate work in Tallahassee, Florida at Florida A&M University. It's a historically Black university in Tallahassee. And for graduate school in chemical engineering, I went to Northwestern. So I lived in Chicago for about 5 years. Then I moved for my postdoc to Baltimore at Johns Hopkins. And then I moved from the East Coast here to LA. So
you've lived everywhere.
Lots of places, lots of climates. Very interesting.
Yeah. So you are originally, would you consider Kansas Southern? Yeah, it's more Southern than Midwestern, right?
It's more Midwestern.
Is it?
That's how we classify ourselves.
Okay. And then Florida is Florida.
Yes. Right. It's not Southern. It's not really anything but Florida.
Yeah. So I was born and raised in Texas, and Texas, I mean, I think they really pride themselves as being Southern, like Southwest is what they really, you know, but there's, I think, a lot of crossover between Texas and Florida, honestly, with the weather, with the people, with all that. And so you've lived in the Midwest. You've lived in Chicago, which is weird because it is the Midwest, but it's not because it's such a big city.
Right, yeah.
You've lived, obviously, here on the West Coast. Has it been, obviously, it must have been a transition each time, but have you found home? Which place feels the most home-like to you?
Well, Kansas City will always be home, right? That's where my family is. That's where I go back for major holidays and stuff.
So you're anchored there.
Anchored there. Yeah. I really loved living in Chicago because there's so much to the city. There's so much to do. Besides the 9 months of gray and cold and windiness.
It's cold
beautiful
there.
In the summer. And then there's lots of festivals, lots of free things to do downtown. So I really enjoyed living in Chicago. But I do feel like I've found a home here, up in Altadena. So not too far from campus, but it's a nice community feel. And I love where we live. So.
Yeah, Altadena's beautiful. And you get to be, you're so close to Pasadena, for anybody who doesn't know the LA area that well, which is where Caltech is, Pasadena City College. It's close to...
JPL is there.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like such a cool little quaint town. Like, is that where you usually go to do shopping and things like that?
Yeah, we stay pretty local. Yeah. There's a little like old town area of Pasadena with lots of restaurants and different shops and stuff. So
yeah,
we don't usually come. I don't usually come into the city on the weekends.
Is though, I have to wonder because so I live, you're visiting me here. This is a very LA conversation, guys. I promise we'll get to the science. I live here in Los Feliz now, which is unfortunately one of these areas of LA that's been really, I think, subject to like heavy gentrification. So it used to be a much more Latino community, and there's still like vestiges of that. So luckily, there's still a lot of interesting people from multiple backgrounds here in Los Feliz, but it's definitely whiter than it used to be, same as Silver Lake. But before I lived in Los Feliz, I lived at, like in the heart of Hollywood, and Hollywood is really diverse, and I loved that about Hollywood. Pasadena feels very white to me when I visit it. Is Altadena the same way?
I will say Altadena is different from Pasadena.
Oh, okay, that's good.
I think there's more diversity there. It's also unincorporated, so people can sort of do whatever they want. So we see actually pretty frequently and regularly horses just on the street. People have chickens, have roosters, have goats in their backyard, right? So people in Altadena, it's like its own community. I will say, yeah, I do think it's more diverse than Pasadena.
Yeah.
So that makes it a little bit different for sure.
There's also this weird culture in California, or at least in Los Angeles, that a lot of people don't know until they've lived here or until they've been involved in academia here, where we have two, I mean, we have a lot of universities, don't get me wrong, but there are two major universities. There's USC and there's UCLA. These are the big ones that a lot of people have heard of. And they're very funny in the sense that USC is private. UCLA is part of the University of California system, so it's public.
Right. Yep.
But USC is in a much poorer neighborhood, but the kids that go there tend to have more means, generally, unless they're there on scholarships and things. And the on the flip side, UCLA is in a very rich neighborhood.
Yes.
It's in Westwood, right? Which is by Brentwood. But because it's a public university, you have more commuter students and students from various backgrounds. So it's such a funny thing that... like that the location and the demographic makeup of the school and the SES of the students that go there are not always in sync. But USC, I have to say, is one of my favorite parts of town because I think that the campus is really beautiful. It's in a very diverse part of town and it's in the museum district. So it's right next to
the Natural History Museum.
Yep.
The Natural History Museum, the Science Center is there. The California African American Museum is there as well.
Oh, very cool.
So it's right across in this sort of museum campus. We go there somewhat frequently. It's pretty easy to get to from camp from my office. But from home, it's a little bit further.
That's for sure.
And but it's nice.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a great place. Like families go, there's a family day, I think at the museum once a month or once a week where it's free for anybody to come visit. And I don't know, it's just, it's got beautiful grounds and stuff. And you know, it's LA, so we get to be outside all the time. So on campus at USC, I want to understand, first, because I'm noticing more and more that when I interview working scientists with university affiliations or that are, you know, on faculty at universities, that the multidisciplinary nature of science is getting to be very confusing, like what department people work in and what it is they do. So at USC, are you in a biology department, or are you in engineering?
I'm in biomedical engineering.
Biomedical engineering. Yes. So, and USC, does USC have a medical school?
They do, yes.
Wow, so there's crossover of all of those things.
That's true, yes. So I'm on the main University Park campus, okay, which is across where from where we were just talking about the museums. And then the health science campus is just about 8 or 9 miles away, but that's far in LA terms.
Oh, it's real far. That's like, yeah, that's like an hour. Yeah.
Right. So that's where some of the professional schools are. So the Keck School of Medicine is there. Physical therapy, occupational therapy, they're all over at the health science campus.
Gotcha. And then Viterbi, which is the mm-hmm. School of Engineering, mm-hmm. that's on the main campus.
That's on the main campus, yes.
And so you kind of have your toe then in these different areas, but there is a biomedical engineering department.
Yes, okay. Yes, within Viterbi.
Okay,
and
cool.
So we have our core faculty, but then also joint faculty that are affiliated and where their primary appointment is in lots of other departments, including Keck, different medical school departments. So yeah, it's very interdisciplinary. I have collaborators on the health science campus on a couple of grants. And so we talk pretty frequently, and then as much as possible also go to one another's office, because of course having the face-to-face conversations is very helpful.
And then is it safe to assume that when you publish with those collaborators?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so before we get to what you're doing right now at USC, I'd love to know, you know, you talked about having to move so much between, because mm-hmm. this is the life of an academic, between undergrad, grad school, postdoc, faculty appointments.
Right.
Were you always an engineer? Did you start in biology? Like, how did you meander? Because I love talking about this when people who are listening to the show are actively navigating their mm-hmm. own academic environment, because mm-hmm. of course, as we're learning more and more, there's no one way to get to where you want to be. So what was your path?
So I've been an engineer from the beginning.
Okay, cool.
My undergraduate and graduate degrees are in chemical engineering. So I did make a little bit of a shift from after graduate school, where I did my postdoc in a biomedical engineering department at Hopkins.
Okay.
So I was always, I think, more interested in sort of what it meant to be an engineer from a practical sense. So I had this mindset of trying to solve an equation where I could have a career that incorporated things that I was interested in, like chemistry, mm-hmm. math, physics, with things that I was good at. And I happened to be good at all those things and enjoy them as well. So I wasn't your maybe stereotypical engineer that was tinkering with things and like taking things apart and trying to figure out how things worked.
So you're
it
like
was
a
more
pen and paper.
Methodological. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. So that's how I sort of decided to move into engineering, and then figuring out what specific discipline. That really didn't happen until like probably my sophomore year as an undergraduate student, just learning more about the chemistry, biochemistry, and how it could work with the hardcore sciences and physics and those types of things. And so, yeah, so I decided to pursue chemical engineering for undergrad and then also for graduate school. But then I got more interested in the health aspect, health and disease. And so in looking for a postdoc, I really focused in on something where I could work on a disease topic or just more physiology. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I was very focused in trying to find something in biomedical engineering or even bioengineering, right, which has that sort of bio spin to it and flavor.
Yeah.
And so that's how I ended up in a BME department at Hopkins.
Interesting.
And then when I was applying for jobs, I just needed a job.
Yeah. Gotcha.
So I applied a super wide net. So I applied to chemical engineering departments, bioengineering, and biomedical engineering. And USC, the biomedical engineering at USC, the department was really just a good fit for me. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I sort of made the decision.
Before you thought to move out, had you ever visited LA or known anything about LA?
No, I knew nothing about LA. So when I came for my interview, which was in 2012, mm-hmm. I was amazed that there were mountains here. Like, I didn't even know the terrain.
It's interesting how like much nature we have.
Yes, exactly. Because you think this concrete jungle and like buildings everywhere, but even downtown, right? It's not like a New York or even a Chicago, right?
Yeah.
And so I was just amazed about how sprawling it was and how there was different flavors of environments every, like all that you can imagine.
Yeah.
So the mountains, the ocean, the desert, right? So I was amazed. I didn't know what to expect.
And also, it's so warm.
Yes.
It's been cold like the past few weeks, but whatever. It
cold.
Is February.
Yeah, no. in quotation.
Yeah. It's so true. We're like, ooh, it's in the 50s. What right. are we going to do? That's so funny. Yeah, I have a coat full of a closet full of coats that I never use.
Right.
From when I lived in New York. Yeah. For that short amount of time that I was like, oh, I need 10 coats. It's funny the process, you know, the meandering process of getting to where you're going to be, especially mm-hmm. in academia, if you stay in academia, right? Some people study in academia, but they end up going to industry or they end up working in areas where their education really prepared them for a life that is not academic, which mm-hmm. is great. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really cool that more and more, I think people are realizing that there are options available right. to people who decide to go to graduate school that aren't right. just staying in university settings.
And I might just inject here that mm-hmm. I think that's actually the majority.
Mm.
The number of faculty positions relative to the number of PhDs that yeah. are being conferred is a very small percentage.
So it has to be the majority.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But when it's talked about in the academic world, it's sort of the alternative career to move out of academia. But yeah. numbers-wise, that's not true.
It's funny, right? There's almost this sheen or this veil that like, well, this is why you're doing it, right? Is to become right. a tenured professor. Why else would you want to go through the hell of like defending yeah. a dissertation? But you're right. There's so many other opportunities
that's
available.
Right.
And of course, we talk a lot about this like leaky pipeline conversation, right? This idea that there's a funnel that early on, when especially if we're talking about any demographic that's not the like heteronormative white male mm-hmm. Protestant, you know, we could list the whole thing, but like, especially with women, especially with people of color, especially mm-hmm. with people of, I would say like gender diversity or orientation diversity, that early on in the career or early on in the process of education, it's a broader net and then it gets narrower and narrower and narrower.
That's true.
Yeah. By the time you get to the top, and this isn't just in academia, it's in industry too, right?
Yeah.
C-suite people, board level seats, it's all
that's
white
right.
dudes still. But this starts to happen like in elementary and middle school.
Mm.
And it's interesting because you talked about the fact that even by the time you were getting into college, you already knew that you loved math, you loved, you know, physics,
mm-hmm.
you loved chemistry.
Right.
And that, unfortunately, I feel like is often the alternative to the norm mm. with young women, especially young women of color.
I agree.
Yeah, part of that is because of the way that we're, you know, treated. Part of
yes.
that is the way that individuals, you know, teachers talk to girls versus boys, talk to people of color versus white people, especially depending on, you know, you went to a historically black university for, mm-hmm. was that for grad school or undergrad?
For undergrad.
For undergrad, which mm-hmm. is like, I can't imagine. Maybe you can tell a little about how you think that affected you and your pathway versus if you had gone to a school that was, I think, predominantly white, for mm-hmm. example.
Sure. Yeah, I think going to FAMU, so Florida A&M University, was definitely formative in terms of building a lot of self-confidence
yeah.
and a lot of self-esteem because most of my professors were people of color. And so I could see myself reflected in the people who were teaching me.
Yeah.
And I very much remember my freshman year taking Calculus 2 with Dr. Sonia Stevens, who was this African-American woman, strong, very vibrant mm. and enthusiastic about teaching calculus, which,
yeah.
first of all, is a feat in and of itself.
yeah.
But then to teach this classroom of students. Also, when I took her freshman year, she was pregnant. And so that helped me also see that, okay, a successful professor could also have a family mm-hmm. and have, you know, personal goals that she's interested in pursuing as well.
And like have womanhood.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yes.
Not
be
like,
feminine and not
yeah,
be ashamed of it.
Exactly.
No, 100%. Yes. So that was really important for me to see.
Yeah.
And not only that from my faculty members, but also from the people who I was in class with. Right. And so we were together. We were at least similar in having that cultural background, that ethnic background that was the same for very many of us.
Yeah.
And so that certainly played a role in what I thought that I could accomplish. And I think that if I had gone to another institution, I certainly would not have gotten that perspective. My high school was It was diverse, but it was predominantly white. Mm-hmm. And then moving from FAMU to Northwestern, right? Worlds apart.
Ooh, yeah.
Which we could talk about. But but I think just having that foundation for 4 years made it really solid and clear who I was and what I thought that I could accomplish. I am funded in part by a National Science Foundation Career Award. And part of the National Science Foundation big push that they have is to do broader impacts, to have broader impact and outreach. And mm-hmm. so I partnered with the 32nd Street School. It's a USC magnet school. It's just across the street from USC.
Oh, cool.
It's predominantly Hispanic and lower income student population. Mm-hmm. And I visit their fourth grade class about 6 times per year. So a few times in the fall and then a few times in the spring. And the main thing that I want to do, right? I'm not teaching them new math, right? Yeah. That's what they have their teacher to do. I'm somewhat reinforcing what she's teaching, but also trying to bring life to some of these mathematics concepts that are not super engaging, like pretty abstract for a fourth grader. Mm-hmm. And so I also link it a little bit to my research, but more so just saying fractions can be exciting, right? If you think about a pizza and you need to cut it in fourths, right? What does that mean in terms of sharing with your friends or not sharing? So I think you're completely right in that students around that age, and there's a lot of literature about this, and this is why I focused first on fourth grade, that's sort of the starting point where women and people of color are turned off from computational thinking. And my research is all about computational modeling and mathematical modeling. And so I think having at least that, and I don't feel like it's enough, right? Just 6 times a year, it's not enough. But I feel like at least they see my face. I talk to them about mathematical concepts and trying to bring them to life. And also just say, you know, math can be exciting and it's okay if you like math, right? Yeah. Because I even ask the question right when we start for them to get to know me and also for me to get to know the class, who likes math? And you can see some students, even some women, are a little bit hesitant about mm-hmm. raising their hand. And it's like, it's okay to like math. And so sometimes you need that reinforcement. Maybe they're not getting it at home, or maybe they're not getting it as much in the classroom as they could be. And so I agree with you 100% that there's a big funneling effect, and it starts earlier than we expect.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny you talk about like how you feel like it's not enough.
It's
like
not
you
enough.
Wish you could be there every day, of course, but seeing, like you said, just seeing your face, like by virtue of being there, that modeling, I feel like we can't say it enough that like, if a kid can't even see themselves in a position,
that's right.
they're never going to pursue it.
Right.
They're going to think it's for somebody else and not for me. Right. And they've got to see people who look like them, who sound like them, who talk like them. And even beyond that, I love that you're talking about this idea of like, it's okay to like math, because what is the dominant narrative in society? Math sucks. Mm-hmm. Math is boring. I suck at math. Like that's right, what their parents are saying. Ew, math. Ew, that's hard. And also, sometimes I wonder too, this idea of there's a boy versus girl thing here more than I think any other kind of demographic, but that there is some literature to show, you know, with stereotype threat literature, that young boys are taught to be more prideful when something is hard. So they'll pretend it's not and they'll work through it. Whereas a girl will voice that it's hard and think, well, if it's hard for me, maybe it's because I'm not good enough at it. So I might as well give up. Mm-hmm. And so also I feel like sometimes embracing the fact that like, yeah, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard, but we'll get through it together.
Yeah, keep pushing.
Yeah. And like, it feels good. It feels better to do something that was hard.
Right.
And you accomplish
feel more,
it.
Exactly.
You know?
Feel more of a sense of accomplishment.
That it's okay that math doesn't come like 100% naturally to you.
Yeah.
Because I know I was one of those kids who was a classic textbook example of a girl who started going through the motions, loving math and science, was in gifted and talented programs, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden I really moved into the more verbally oriented, more poetry, less engineering, less math. And I still did all of it across the gamut because I was in those programs. But I was like, I don't like math. Math is hard. Mm-hmm. It's not for me. I'm not ever going to be in a math field. And I went towards psychology and biology and literature and away from those things simply for that reason.
I see.
There's that dichotomy, right?
Yeah.
That we teach.
Yeah. You sometimes feel that you have to choose.
Mm-hmm.
You can be good at lots of different things. Maybe you don't have a natural affinity for math or the sciences, but you can still be really good at it.
Yeah.
And I think that that voice that you have in your head about, oh, this is not for me, that's really what turns people off. Right. So,
yeah.
Of course, also the external inputs that they have as well.
Yeah. The societal inputs. And
yeah.
Of course, we talk about we've been talking about role modeling. But also when we talk about various backgrounds, like this is a perfect example, the 32nd Street School that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Right. When it comes to the actual science, which I think we need to, you know, obviously we've been talking already for 23 minutes about what you do for a living, that it's important for the science, and especially for an applied science,
right,
that you don't just have one type of person working on it, because then, of course, you're not serving the entire community. And what we're talking here is about serving patients,
mm-hmm.
right? Serving
mm-hmm.
people in the healthcare system. And let's be real. Who's in the healthcare system? Everybody.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Right? Like sickness. Cancer is not racist.
That's
cancer
true.
Is not a privilege. Anybody can get cancer.
That's right.
It does
yeah.
not matter how much money you have. It does not matter how much,
education
you have. It doesn't matter
background.
Who your parents were.
That's right. Yeah.
It's, you know, the treatment we get sometimes is incredibly, unfortunately, variable based on, I think, societal stratification
mm-hmm.
and based on means. But you, of course, are working on understanding cancer at a very basic level,
yes.
right? We're talking about like cellular biology.
Yes.
And so tell me about the interaction then, the intersection between cancer biology, which I think of as a very wet science,
mm-hmm.
and engineering, which I think of as a very non-wet science.
Yeah, hard science. Yeah,
yeah.
So what I do is to basically try to represent the biology using mathematical equations.
Mm.
So I look at, there are a few different perspectives that we can take. So I look at what's happening inside of cells
okay.
in terms of what their signaling pathways are. So what that means is how a cell will receive some external input, some external stimulus, and then need to respond in a certain way. So a cancer cell may be in a very harsh environment with not a lot of nutrients, not a lot of oxygen. And so it needs to be able to thrive. And actually it does thrive, right? By exploiting very normal processes that healthy cells have. So it needs to be able to take in at least the minimum nutrients that are available and use those as efficiently as possible.
Yeah.
So that's part in terms of what we're talking about is metabolism. So how the cell will take in those nutrients, convert them into energy and other building blocks that it can use to make more cells. So those are the kind of pathways and reactions that we look at.
Because,
and then also signaling pathways in terms of how the cell is stimulated and then needs to respond in a certain way.
Okay. So to be clear, a cancer cell is just a cell in your body that is like, I'm just going to replicate. And replicate and replicate.
Right, exactly.
Like, I'm a totally normal cell in your body that decided to not be normal anymore, and now I'm taken over.
Right.
It's
yeah.
not something from outside of you. It's
no.
your own body.
Right. It's resident cells that are already in your different tissues
mm-hmm.
that have some change, some mutation, it's called, that causes them to be hyper proliferative. So they're growing and they're multiplying and dividing much more quickly than a normal healthy cell. They also have, you know, some protection mechanisms because of those mutations, those changes that allow them to remain growing and dividing even in a very harsh or nutrient poor environment. So it's
so
not something that you acquire from
yeah.
someone like a virus.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's already, these cells are already inside of you. And cancer cells can be dormant, meaning be there and be cancerous and diseased for years before a tumor would actually form.
Mm.
Right. So there are some environmental inputs that can affect the growth of a tumor. But primarily what you have is what you have.
Yeah. So your DNA is already got some sort of, or the DNA slowly changes to have that sort of instruction from carcinogens from viruses, you know, different kinds of things can induce it. But the cancer cells themselves, that's where the exploitation comes in, right? They're taking these metabolic capabilities that all body cells have.
That's right.
But they're like ramping them up.
Exactly. Yes.
And so you're studying those pathways?
Yes. So we have two main areas. Well, I would say three main areas of research in my lab.
Okay.
One is looking at metabolism.
Okay.
So how the cells will take in those nutrients and convert them to energy and other building blocks. Again, that's something that healthy, every cell has metabolic pathways that it needs and uses. Another line of research is the signaling pathways. So like a cell will get some stimulus that tells it to grow, and cancer cells are more sensitive to that. And so they can respond more quickly and more specifically to those growth signals. And then we also look at the immune system. So in the scientific literature and research right now, immunotherapy is really big. Probably over the last, I would say, 5 to 8 years, it's gotten a lot of attention, both research-wise and in the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And so we look at the immune cells, which are, again, naturally occurring cells in your body that are told and supposed to attack foreign cells like cancer cells and also like viruses. And so we look at the signaling pathways inside of an immune cell and how we can maybe activate those and exploit those more to be able to target tumor cells.
Gotcha. Because one of the tricky genius things about cancer, many types of cancer, I don't know if all cancer is like this, you could tell me, but is that it's like, it tricks your body's immune system into thinking it's supposed to be
there. Exactly.
Yeah. Like,
so a normal cell that the immune cells would recognize as being foreign, that shouldn't be there, has certain things that are presented on its surface. So certain molecules that are on the surface of this foreign cell, and the tumor can evade the immune system by not presenting those molecules on its cell surface.
Tricky.
So it can evolve, right? If it knows that the immune system is looking for a certain type of molecule then that it would normally express, it can evolve to not express those cells. So that's evading the immune system in different ways.
Yeah. So it's, even if at the beginning your body starts to fight off the cancer, it'll eventually not be able to.
It could, yes. So have resistance to therapies and evolve in such a way that it's very difficult to treat.
Yeah. Okay. So these are things that we know, right? We know that cancer cells have, let's say, hardy metabolisms.
Mm-hmm.
We know that cancer cells have a lot of cell signaling, necessary cell signaling in order to do all the things that they do, mostly grow and divide, right? That's kind of all they do.
Yes.
Cancer's like, I will just be, and I will be more of myself.
Yeah,
I
will and migrate to other places.
You're right.
In the
body. Metastasize, go around, get all up in that lymph or that blood, which is bad. But they're not really functional in the sense that, like, if it's a skin cell, if it's a bone cell, if it's a brain cell, if it's whatever, it's not really doing the things that skin and bone and brain are supposed to do. Just like forming a mass. And, growing out of whack. So they metabolize their cell signaling, and then of course they're evading the immune system. So these are things we've known probably for, decades of cancer biology.
Sure.
And so what are you doing with that information in your lab?
Yeah. So I think, yes, in general, we know a lot about the behavior of tumor cells.
Mm-hmm.
But what we don't necessarily know as much about are the specific dynamics over which things happen. So the time scales over which things happen. And so my mathematical models will predict the concentrations of proteins or metabolites inside of the cell and how those concentrations change with time. That's difficult to measure experimentally, especially with a patient sample.
Yeah.
And so having a math, and also there are lots of different reactions that are happening all at the same time. And usually in cancer biology, it's much more of a reductionist approach. So I'm going to take one molecule and study it to death. or I'm going to take one set of reactions and really understand them in as much detail and depth as I can.
Yeah.
Whereas the models that we build can incorporate lots of different molecules, lots of different chemical reactions, biochemical reactions that happen inside of the cell, and understand the dynamics of all of those things at a system level over time.
Gotcha.
And so that's helpful then, because we can say, we can do some different computational analyses which say, oh, well, this reaction in the context of this broader system, this particular reaction is really important. And so maybe that's a new target for a drug therapy. Or we can go the reverse and say, oh, well, we have this drug that's working in some other disease or some other setting, and we know somewhat about the mechanism by which it works. And mm-hmm. so we can use our model to say, well, how would it affect a tumor cell given all of the metabolic and signaling pathways that are happening? So I think from my mathematical models, we get more of a detailed mechanistic understanding of what's happening instead of just saying, oh, this process is occurring. How is it occurring? What's the time scale over which it's occurring? And how sensitive is it to changes in the network?
Wow. So that's obviously the two things that stick out to me most when you describe that is that you must be dealing with, I mean, when we use the term big data, like so many measurements and trying to coalesce all these things mm-hmm. to understand how they all work together. And the second thing is what you're doing is not theoretical in nature, right? Are you actually utilizing measured data and mm-hmm. plugging that in and iterating these algorithms yes. over time? You're not just building a model from scratch.
Right, that's right. So two things, right? Mm-hmm. You mentioned big data. So now we have a lot of information at our fingertips
yeah.
that we can use to build better, more predictive models. But you're right also in that we do a lot, even to construct a model, right? Which reactions are there? Which enzymes are catalyzing these reactions? That takes a lot of reading of the literature to at least know what's already been studied mm-hmm. and explored.
From that reductionistic standpoint,
from the
right?
Reduction, yeah. Right. So we're piecing things together. Mm-hmm. Yes, very much a puzzle. Putting things together in our more comprehensive mathematical model and then using the equations to solving them to see, well, what happens over time. And now that there's more data available, then we can use that to better fit our model, right? So we want to first make sure we have the components there based on what's already been known from cancer biology. And then we want to make sure that our model at least reproduces the experimental measurements that have already been taken so that we have some confidence in what the model would, predictions that it would give us.
Yeah.
So once we have fit the model to the experimental data, then we can use it to make new predictions like, well, what happens if I turn off a reaction? Or if I simulate administering this drug, how does the body respond or how does the tumor cell respond?
All right. I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with a new sponsor, Puppo. They make pet parenting easier because they take the guesswork out of choosing the right food for your dog. And of course, dogs are all different. They're unique. They could be big or small or young or old or super hyper or totally lazy, like Mr. Killer, who is, yes, a lap dog, and I love him for it. With Puppo, they create a tailored nutrition plan and they prepare personalized food that's blended just for your dog's health and lifestyle. There's a team of pet nutritionists, and they really utilize a lot of, you know, food science in order to formulate the right mix. And so you get a bunch of great options here. Like I said, personalized nutrition that's developed by those pet nutritionists, really good quality ingredients, and a smart delivery system. So you only get as much food as your dog would eat for that month. And it actually is measured out for you. So you know exactly how much to feed your dog each day based on the dog's age, size, the size of your dog's mouth, right? If it's a little dog versus a really big dog, the kibble needs to be a different size. Your dog's activity level, if there's any special needs, like my dog has kind of itchy skin. And so I was able to really tailor it that way. Sensitivities, whether or not your dog needs to lose or gain weight. And it's really cute because when you get your bag in the mail, it has a picture of your dog on it and your name is, or your dog's name is right there. So it really is completely customized. Oh, and another thing, it apparently tastes really good. I mean, I wouldn't know. I didn't try it, but my dog Killer like lost his mind over this food compared to his old kibble. When we put this down, he cleaned his plate fast, although I don't feed them in a plate. I feed them in a little treat feeder, but that's besides the point. So guys, you've got to try this out for your little puppo. Go to puppo.com/nerdy. And guess what? You'll get 14 days of personalized dog food delivered for only $9. So again, that's puppo.com/nerdy. I also want to thank Mova for their support of the show. Now, I know I've been telling you about Mova for a few weeks now, and apparently you guys are listening because I know that some of you have picked up your very own Mova globes. For those of you who haven't, but you've been thinking about it, I highly recommend it. They make incredible gifts for, you know, friends, family, yourself. Yeah, I now have two Mova globes. Thank you very much. I have a Mars globe and I also have an Earth globe with clouds. And here's the thing about Mova globes. They rotate all by themselves. There's no batteries. There's no, you don't have to plug them in and charge them. They are powered actually by light. It's really cool technology. You can read about it online, but it doesn't even have to be in bright sunlight. They can just be exposed to ambient light, like the lights in your room. And there's these hidden magnets inside, and they rotate slowly and soothingly all by themselves. Now, you don't just have Mars and you don't just have the Earth, although I would be pleased. I am pleased with both of those. There are the rest of the planets. You can get, you know, Mercury, you can get Jupiter, you can get Saturn, and there are other solar system objects as well. There's a Titan globe, right? So Saturn's moon Titan, and they work directly with a member of the Cassini mission to create that design. There's even a Vesta asteroid globe. And I mean, maybe you're not into space, I guess. There's also really cool artwork globes, like you can get a Van Gogh globe or a Monet globe. I love the space one, so I got to admit it. So I don't know what you're waiting for at this point, and I know you want to get one, so go online and check them out right now. It's www.movaglobes.com/nerdy, and make sure you use the coupon code nerdy because you'll get 10% off your purchase. And again, that's www.movaglobes.com/nerdy. Make sure to use the coupon code nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. So when I think about, you know, all of the different research, especially biomedical research that utilizes big data, which has become this buzzword, oftentimes when we think of big data, we think of like a bucket full of data points and then literally like throwing stuff at the wall to see what sticks. But what you're talking about is a scaffolding that you've built and you're only plugging the data in onto that scaffolding.
That's right.
So you're not falling victim to some of the big data pitfalls, like some of the, they just did a big, they, I don't remember the researcher's name, which I feel terrible about, but we talked about it on the SGU, my other podcast, I think this week, that one of the speakers at AAAS a couple weeks ago was talking about some of the pitfalls of big data, like p-hacking and all these false positives and things, because basically just as a function of having so much information, you're always going to find patterns in
something,
the noise.
You'll find something.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the bigger that N, the more patterns you're going to find, which is why you have to have like a priori assumptions. But your entire model is a priori. You're building a scaffolding and then plugging the data into it.
Yeah. So the one sort of downfall or limitation of the data that's available in some cases is that it's not time series data. So you get one snapshot in time. You get a lot of information at that specific time, but how does it evolve, right? And so that's really what the mathematical model can tell us. And so we unfortunately can't take advantage of every data set that's out there.
Yeah.
We have to pick and choose and also decide, you know, based on the network that we're interested in studying, how does the data map onto the scaffold, as you call it, how does it map onto that networking or that scaffold that we have? And so I think it's exciting that there are more sets of experiments and sets of experimental data that we can take advantage of, but sometimes it's not the right data.
Ugh, that must be frustrating. And you're talking about both human data and animal models, I'm assuming.
And also,
stick with human?
So we try to use human data, but right now in our very basic science models, we're using animal data and then a lot of in vitro cell culture data.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, because you can see all sorts of cancer outcomes in a petri dish.
Yes. as closely as possible, right? It's not exactly mimicking the patient setting, but there are more and more experimental models that are getting closer to that. So not just like 2D plastic dish growing the cells, but tissue or 3D organoids that you can grow with multiple cell types, not just cancer there, right? You can also have the fibroblasts that are associated to the with the cancer cells, the immune cells you can also have in the organoid. So that's actually what I'm collaborating with Shannon Mumenthaler about at the Keck School of Medicine. She has a very nice experimental system that gives us the data that we need to use to calibrate our models and also to validate the model predictions.
Because of course, in an organoid, like you said, you have the support cells, you have the cancer cells, and you have to have the healthy tissue as well to see how all those things interact with each other.
Right, exactly.
Because if we're just looking at one cancer cell or a tumor type that's like homogeneous, you're not going to get as clean a picture of what's happening inside a person's body.
Right, as accurate a picture, for sure.
Wow. Do you use HeLa cells ever?
So we have it in our work, but I know, of course, about the history. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's really exciting. When I was at Hopkins, right, because that's where everything started. So, and we can talk about the history of that. But when I was there, Rebecca Skloot, the author of the book.
The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks.
Yeah. She came and the Lacks family came.
Wow.
And she did a reading of her book.
Oh, wow.
And so there's still some, you know, friction between the Lacks family and like NIH and other people.
Sure. You know, there's a lot of ethical
companies who have taken advantage of that technology. But I was just really excited to see the author, to see some of the family members, and to be right in the heart of where it started.
Yeah. Guys, so, if you don't know anything about the HeLa story, about Henrietta Lacks and about this cancer cell line that was taken basically without consent from a patient who had, was it cervical cancer?
Cervical cancer.
Yeah, and literally became the key cell line in almost every laboratory across the world. It's a fascinating story of this basically ambivalence, right? There's a deep ambivalence about the fact that this cell type has saved so many lives. Mm. But at the same time, this was utter and more than questionable, deeply unethical practices taking somebody's personal information, their personal data, their personal actual tissue without their consent. And of course, the conversation here is because this was a less informed, poorer Black family in an era. When was this? It was early in the 1900s or like mid-1900s.
Yeah.
I'm going to look it up because that's obviously a big part of the conversation, right?
Right. It was before informed consent was even a thing.
Yeah. 1951 is when she died. So it was, she was born in 1920. She died in 1951. So it was just before she died, right? And then they used those cells. This is before informed consent. It changed a lot of the way that we do these practices. And of course, people have profited off of that.
Yes,
a lot of people have done nonprofit, incredible work, and people, countless lives have been saved downstream from that. But also a lot of big companies have profited off of this. And the family didn't really see any of that, which is where the tension comes in. So I highly recommend Rebecca Skloot's book. It's incredible.
Yes.
I think they did an HBO special on it with Oprah,
right? Oprah. Yeah. I watched it too. It was pretty consistent with the book.
Yeah, and it actually was pretty good with the science, I felt like.
Yeah.
Which is not always the case.
That's true.
So yeah, highly recommend, but that's fascinating that you got to, you know, see the family speak and see the, I don't know, we don't often get that. What do they call it whenever you watch Antiques Roadshow? This is such a dumb thing to say. Provenance. Mm-hmm. You know, like when there's an artifact of history and it's so far removed from our everyday lives. Mm-hmm. And we've only heard about it in newspapers and books. But then all of a sudden we get to read the letter of the person who made that piece of pottery, or we get to see the hands that it passed through, or things, to see all the rich history around it and be lucky enough that her kids were still alive.
Right, yeah.
And could have those conversations about what it meant to them.
Right, exactly.
Oh my God, so... Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say cool. That's not the right word. You know what I
but
mean?
But fascinating.
It's so much more.
It's a very interesting story.
Yeah, it's horribly depressing.
True.
Yeah. And there's a lot of deep, you know, obviously discomfort around it, but it is fascinating. Yeah. So your lab doesn't actively use HeLa because you need more than just a cell line. You need all these interplays.
Right. So, and it's also the type of cancers that we're looking at.
Oh, really?
So
okay.
For the metabolism piece, we're looking at colorectal cancer and also pancreatic cancer.
Oof.
So, yeah, very devastating, progressive disease. And then for some of the other signaling models that we have, we're looking at breast cancer. So it's just making sure that the experimental tool set that you're utilizing is relevant to the disease setting that you want to study.
So your work is interesting because it's not quite basic research. It's not quite applied. It's like, it, would you call it like, what do they call it? Translational? It's somewhere in the chain.
It's sort of in the middle,
yeah.
Right? Because we're taking advantage of the basic knowledge of what's known about these different cancers.
Mm-hmm.
But we can also study therapeutics and see, well, how existing therapeutics are affecting these signaling networks and metabolic networks, but then also identify potential new targets for drugs. So I will say we're sort of spanning. I wouldn't call it necessarily translational, because in my mind, that means, oh, we've identified a drug and we're ready to take it, translate it into the clinic.
Yeah.
But it's not on the far end of the spectrum of just being basic science.
Yeah. You're not just doing like animal studies and collecting very basic data that like is hard to even imagine how it's going to be used in a medical setting.
Right. Yeah.
So, okay, I've asked this question before to some of my friends who are theoretical astrophysicists, which is like, okay, what does this have to do with your work? And I'm like, what does your lab look like? And they're like, oh, it's just computers.
Yes.
Your lab just computers too?
It's just computers.
I love that.
But I still call it a lab.
Yeah.
That's where the research is being done.
Exactly. I love that.
Yes.
So your graduate students, your undergrads, your postdoc, all the different people that work with you in your research team, they spend a lot of time in front of a computer.
Yes.
That's what they have to do.
That's what they do.
Do you have to use any sort of like supercomputers to do your analyses?
Yeah. So especially when we're talking about fitting a model to experimental data, that can be pretty computationally intense and expensive. And so in terms of the time and the computing power, power. And so, yes, we take advantage of the high performance computing cluster at USC.
Oh, cool.
But most of our models, just the baseline, just sort of putting the model together and making some baseline predictions, all of that can be done on a personal computer.
So is it hard for you to get your grad students to actually show up to the lab when they're like, I could just do this at home?
No, it hasn't been that difficult.
That's good.
And of course, it really started from the first graduate student that I had who was actually doing experimental work with a co-advisor, my collaborator, and then computational modeling using the data that she was acquiring in the lab.
So she
and
had
so
to
she
go to
had
class.
To be
yeah,
there.
To
so it set up this culture where everyone comes in. But I think that's an important piece of science is the conversation and the sort of by chance interactions that you have. So in my lab, everyone's there every day.
Mm-hmm.
Rarely do people work from home. I work from home to get some more writing done and to, you know, edit my students' papers and write grants and stuff like that.
Oh, because you're also, edit their submissions or edit, like, you're also teaching those students' papers?
Edit my graduate students' papers.
Gotcha,
yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's true. Because when you're a PI, right, when it's your lab, you have to worry about administrative shit.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah, that is like, oh man, this is a part of my job now.
Yeah, that I wasn't trained to do.
Right? Isn't it a funny thing? You know, we talk about this a lot. I have a lot of friends who work in SciComm and who kind of have non-traditional academic careers. And we talk a lot about like all the things for people who do become faculty that you are expected to do the minute you become faculty where you're like, why didn't they I took
exactly.
so many classes in grad school and not a one was about how to teach.
Right.
Or how to
hire the right person, right? You're a human resources person. You're a business manager because you're putting grants together and figuring out how to pay your students and make sure that they can live in LA.
Right.
And then also writing grants, right? So you have to be a good marketer of your work. You have to be a good writer. and communicator. So I go to conferences a lot. I give talks at different institutions around the country. And so I have to be able to communicate my science in a way that's understandable to a broader audience.
Yeah.
Not just modelers. And
so, which is important because your science could get very in the weeds very quickly
right.
when you're talking to other professionals in your field.
Right. Yes. So if I'm talking to someone else who does computational modeling and is in this field of systems biology, where we're looking at, again, the systems level understanding of a biological network or process, then I can talk about the equations and the computational approaches that we use. But if I'm talking to someone who's more broadly in biomedical engineering or chemical engineering, then I want to leave that stuff out so that they get to the heart and the essence of what we're trying to do.
Or like talking to me right now,
yes,
talking
exactly.
to the audience. Yeah, I'm like, I didn't have to do any calculations so far. Thank you for that.
Perfect.
But you also have to teach at some point, and you have to interface with administration, that all the managing up you have to do as a faculty member, and again, advocating for your work within your department when there's other people vying for attention, resources, all
space,
of that.
Yes.
Space. I mean, gosh, it makes me wonder how much time a PI actually has to do basic research. Like, how much time do you get? If you had to, let's take that pizza. We'll go to the fourth grade class again. And you had to take that slice out, which is actually you being in the lab, being able to really dedicate. It's not much, is it?
It's a very small percentage of my time. So that's something else that we have to get used to almost from day one of being a principal investigator of a lab, running a lab, is that what you're trained to do as a graduate student, as a postdoc, is to put your head down and do the research, write your papers and get your degree or get your, postdoctoral training. But as a PI, you're doing all these other things and you're training students and postdocs to do the research. So very rarely actually do I get to do any modeling or coding myself, which makes me sad because I enjoy it, right? We started off this whole conversation about how I got into engineering and what I enjoy doing. And I enjoy writing MATLAB code and trying to debug my code and figure out what's wrong. And so actually when a student comes in and says that they have an issue, it's first nature for me to say, well, give me your code and I'll fix it for you.
Yeah.
But now I have to be like, let me empower you to do it yourself.
Damn it.
So, but the thing is that, right, I get some satisfaction out of seeing a student progress in a way that they come in with very little knowledge and experience with mathematical modeling and they leave being very solid in that. And so that progression and knowing that I had a part in that and like ask the right questions and probe them and push them, that is satisfying as well. I still want to debug their code.
Of course. And there's always going to be something that's so difficult that nobody can figure it out except for you. So,
Yes.
Every so often.
They come to me and I provide information.
Oh, and thank you, by the way, for clarifying what I was mentioning PI, like not a private investigator, guys.
Yes.
Principal investigator.
Right.
Different kind of,
right.
investigator.
Yes.
I love it. Oh, man. So it's fascinating to hear about the different kinds of labs, because I think when we think cancer biology, first of all, we don't think engineering. Second of all, we don't think like, I don't want to say theoretical because it's not theoretical, but a computational lab. We often think of wet labs. We think of animal research. We think of even biomedical research in a hospital looking at tumors that have been taken out of a person, excised out of the body. We think of animal models where we force these mice to grow tumors and then we see what happens. But the cool thing is you're utilizing the data from those wet approaches and then you're modeling with it. So it's like closing the loop in that way.
Yes, exactly. And there's a lot of iteration between the mathematical modeling and the experimental studies, especially with a close collaborator, right? So I get data, either published data or from a collaborator, to build the model. I make some predictions, and then we need to be able to validate and test those predictions. So we go back to our collaborator and say, this is a potential experiment that we think could really validate what the model is saying. And they willingly, excitingly, will do those experiments. And so we can either refine the model if something is not matching up between the data and the predictions, or we can move forward with a clinical collaborator or a preclinical study in mice to further test and see, well, does it hold up under a more complex and hopefully realistic setting? And so I think more and more, and there are a lot of different examples of this happening across the country, where mathematical modeling and computational modeling is going hand in hand with traditional wet lab experiments.
Yeah.
And even all the way up to like a tumor board with patient samples and trying to predict and identify which patients will be the best subset to undergo this type of treatment, and what will their response be? Well, some models can predict those responses. And so I think it's really natural that it goes hand in hand. And NIH is supporting this more, so the National Institutes of Health, NSF as well. And so there are funding agencies that are supporting this collaboration and connection, really integration between mathematics and biology.
That's so cool. And I guess I didn't even realize, it makes perfect sense, but I think the initial assumption as you're sitting here passively and learning about this for the first time is that it's all a one-way street, right? Mm-hmm. That these wet lab researchers are just giving you their data and then you're doing with it what you can. But really, you're right. It's iterative and it's a full feedback loop. You're saying, oh, now that I know this, can you do this experiment?
That's right.
And it's continuously cycling. Do they ever reach out to you and be like, can you help me with my statistics?
Sometimes, but that's not my forte. So I have to say no.
I know what it's like to be in a wet lab and be like, oh, I worked in a computational neurophysiology lab for my entire master's training. And it was interesting because there were a bunch of physicists in my lab doing network level modeling. But because my background is psychology and neuroscience, I basically, on all the published papers I'm with, I don't understand any of the calculations, but I did all the wet work for them. And so it is funny to see how sometimes when it takes so much training to get expertise in a specific area that obviously there's collaboration, but there's still even some siloed information where it's like, you just can't know everything. So you might have multiple people published on the same paper where they're like, yeah, I didn't really understand that paper.
But it's the integration of the different perspectives, I think, really can move science forward and
make huge strides
because it's no longer one lab that can make these huge discoveries. It's a lot of labs coming together.
Because before, just the technology wasn't there, right? But like, we were mostly limited by technology. But when we didn't have computational power and we were doing everything mechanistically or electrically, it was a completely different world. And now that we're doing things computationally, we're modeling, we have AI, we have big data. It's just impossible for one working group to have all the skills required to do anything anymore.
Yeah.
And so if you want to stay siloed, you're going to be left behind, I think.
Right. Yeah. I agree 100%. The big discoveries are happening with collaborative research groups. That's also coming back to the diversity of perspectives, right? My engineering background is useful when I'm talking with a cancer biologist or a physicist. And similarly, their background, which is different from mine, is also complementary, right? And so the more people that we get in a lab or a collaborative project with different perspectives, I think the better.
Yeah.
Because you're thinking outside of your box, which is totally like not even connected to my box. So I think it's really interesting. And that's what has to happen in science.
I love that. And it brings it back to the conversations we're having earlier, because of course, those differences in perspective are across disciplines, they're across training models, they're across just flavors within those training models, but they're also across demographic areas, right? I came from a different neighborhood than you. I learned at a different university than you. I'm a woman, so I think differently than a man. I have this ethnic background, you know, I'm Puerto Rican, you're African American. We're coming at it from these different perspectives than an individual who's always done it the way that they did it in their school, in their hood, in their neighborhood.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's so cool to see. And that's the kind of stuff that like, it just is. This is what psychology is teaching us more and more. You are the amalgamation of all things that ever happened to you in your life. And you can't really change those things. You are who you are because of everything that you ever went through, right? And instead of trying to change us to be other than we are, which is ludicrous, we need to understand that it takes more than just one of us.
Right.
It takes us from all the, like the puzzle. You went back to that puzzle, those puzzle pieces. Why would you want to do a puzzle where every piece looks the same?
Right, exactly.
the picture would not be that interesting.
Right. Yeah. So it's like embrace and accept that we have differences.
Yeah.
And then see how we can exploit those differences. That just makes sense to me.
Of course. Yeah, it makes sense to me. And it blows my mind that there are still people for whom it really doesn't make sense. Yeah. And I think it's, I get it at a certain point. I want to be empathic to the idea that like traditionalists are uncomfortable. The human condition is that we're uncomfortable with change and growth and evolution. It's scary. Nobody likes being wrong. Nobody likes being left behind. Nobody likes having to relearn the things that they already learned. It's comfortable to think you know the way that things are. Right. And so I get it when people are like, no, I just want to do it the way we always did it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we live in a world where shit happens fast.
Yeah. You have to evolve and you have to change with the times.
So I got to ask, we're getting low on time, but because I don't want to out you for your age. I hate asking people how old they are on air, but like, I've got to assume that we're similar in age, that we're kind of like older millennials.
Yes,
older millennials. You don't have to say how old you are, but
yes, but I don't really identify with millennials.
Me neither.
But,
exactly.
So I think we're probably the same age.
Like technically, we're on the tail end of being a millennial. Yeah, but I don't
but
identify.
But that's not.
With that.
Those are not my people.
Exactly.
Which is okay.
It's okay. But it is funny to think about the fact that, like, when I was in elementary school, we didn't have computers yet, and then now you have students in your lab who are. Just from the time they were born, they were swiping.
That's right.
What?
Yes.
Are you finding that those kids are, and even probably their kids soon, right? Because they're going to have kids soon, are going to be more natural in things like coding?
I do, yes.
That's
because
cool.
They just have an appreciation for and a comfort level with technology, right? That like my parents' generation did not. And so I think that they are more interested in technology and coding is just a part of that. And so it's exciting. And to think that more and more people are getting into doing those types of activities because they can be, you know, gateways to lots of different careers and trajectories and paths.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many things you can do if you know how to code, like so many things. And I've got to admit, I'm a do as I say, not as I do kind of person because I'm all about, you know, you got to understand the technology and it's the only way to really be liberated and really like be able to thrive in the world that we live in that's so, you know, tech heavy. And yet I'm like, coding seems hard. I'm at an age and I'm at a point in my education where like the idea of sitting down and learning how to code would feel like the kind of endeavor, like sitting down and learning how to speak Icelandic.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It just seems so overwhelming to me because unfortunately the computer literacy courses that I took in middle school were touch typing courses.
Yeah.
It was a completely different era.
Yeah.
So, and we're the last of that generation, I think.
Yeah. Oh. Like I the closest I got was keyboarding, like learning how to type on a typewriter.
On a typewriter, right? Yeah.
So I have two daughters, 5-year-old and an 8-year-old.
And one on the way.
And one on the way, yes. Well, I don't know. We don't know if it's a girl or a boy.
Oh, yes.
I have another on the way.
A child on the way.
A child on the way. But my 8-year-old now, she's in second grade. So over the summer, we put her in a coding class and it was all touchscreen and then some keyboarding as well, but they're much more tactical. Mm-hmm. So they appreciate that more easily. But really what she learned, she didn't learn the coding per se. She learned the thought process of what it means to put together a string of commands. And so it's actually very engaging for her because it's more like a game, right? Yep. I need to get this character over two humps in a row and then jump up three heights, like three different blocks, in order to get the candy at the top.
Yep.
And so it's how many times you need to repeat a particular action and then string those together. Eventually, it will come back to, okay, what does it mean to actually code and force the character to do it? But first, it's just thinking about what is the set of actions that I need to get there. And so I think soon, like earlier and earlier, kids are being exposed to this kind of technology.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sets a foundation for mathematical thinking and computational thinking. And so it's really exciting to me, I think.
It's so cool to see that causal thread where, you know, we are so used to utilizing code in our daily lives, but we mm-hmm. never see like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain.
It.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
like we play video games and we know that all those are coded.
Yes.
But we just, it's somebody else's problem. Whereas like young kids, it's cool, especially with the fact that robotics are becoming cheaper and cheaper,
mm-hmm.
that there are like really cool coding classes and coding kits where kids not only are writing the code, like you said, for like a video output, but mm-hmm. to actually make a physical machine mm-hmm. move. And sometimes they even get to build the machine
mm-hmm.
and then make the machine follow these coded commands. It's like yeah. such a cool thing that you're right. It's going to become natural. It is natural for them.
Yeah.
So cool. Well, Stacey, I've kept you an hour now. Can you believe it? And I know you've got to run, but I close every episode by asking my guests the same two questions, and they're big picture questions. I know you cheated and you listened to some episodes, so you might already be ready. But I want you to think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you right now, the future of your work, the future of your life, the future of humanity. I mean, gosh, they could get as big as you want or as narrow as you want. And number one, what is the thing that really does keep you up at night? What is the thing that, you know, you're most concerned about, maybe a little pessimistic, maybe borderline cynical about, where you're just feeling like, ugh, it's not looking good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really legit worried about this. And on the flip side of that, what is the thing that you are genuinely, fundamentally optimistic about? It's not lip service. It's not, you know, a saccharine Valentine's Day card, but you actually really are hopeful and mm-hmm. excited about in the future.
Sure. So I didn't know that you would ask these questions. That's the truth. But my answer to them is actually connected.
Mm-hmm.
So the models that we build are very detailed, very mechanistic. They have lots of pieces there, lots of puzzle pieces. And so it keeps me up at night and worries me a little bit that they're too detailed to be translated and useful in the clinic, right? To a physician or an oncologist who wants to take the predictions that we have made and then use them to inform the decisions for their patients.
Yeah, to treatment plan.
For treatment plan. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Which is ultimately what is our goal in having these models, is to be able to identify new strategies and to help aid in those decisions that the clinicians are making. And so it worries me a lot that maybe the models, we're taking the systems level view, and I definitely believe that it's necessary in order to understand more fully how cancer grows and how we can treat it. But it also worries me that they are in a lot of ways too complex and too detailed.
But ultimately, do you feel like those physicians will have to, like an ultimate downstream effect of the research, I could see being risk-benefit analyses, percentiles of confidence, conversations where they don't actually have to ever look at the model, but they get to see these downstream outcomes where it's like, you know, there's a 12% likelihood that this type of treatment is going to affect and blah, blah, blah. There's a 64%. And if this doesn't work, this would be the next stage.
Right.
So that it's more tangible for
yeah.
them as health providers.
Right. Yeah. So basically putting together the decision tree
yeah.
that they go through in their mind, right? But actually having quantitative information and this dynamic mathematical model to inform those decisions.
The decision tree, but they don't ever have to look at the dynamics. They don't ever have to worry about the stochastic nature of some of these things.
Yes.
That maybe they're not as linear as we want them to be.
Right, exactly. But I do think that right now our models are not in the place to even provide that information.
Yeah.
And so it's really thinking about and having discussions with clinicians and with oncologists and with the experimental side of the science to say, what is it that you would want as an input and an output? And
yeah.
then how can I fashion my model to be true to the science, true to the chemistry and the physics that are happening in order to give you the tool that would be most useful in your practice.
Isn't it funny? It's like this, it's almost like science communication in a way. It's like you don't want to leave anything out because it's so rich and you're afraid that the minute you start leaving stuff out and you're simplifying it and now it's no longer as reflective of reality. But at the same time, it's actually detrimental to the outcome to leave too much information in because people are going to glaze over and they're going to, I can't work with this.
Right. Yeah.
I don't understand.
They're going to shut off. Right. Exactly. So you're right. That's a good analogy in terms of how I present my work and making sure that it's understandable in a very similar way. The model needs to be useful and understandable and relevant to the specific questions that the clinicians want to answer for their patients.
Although there's a part of you inside that must die every time when you're like, no, but you need to know this too.
I know. And in my presentations, there's not one equation. I have backup sides, right? We all have backup sides with all the equations and explanations about the
for
algorithms.
The one student who walks up after.
Afterwards,
ooh,
right.
Can I see the source material? Yeah.
So we still have that. But that's also linked to the second part of your question, which is, what am I really hopeful about? Hmm. So we talked about how the modeling really goes hand in hand with the clinical practice. And again, there are examples around the country where this is happening at cancer treatment centers, at medical facilities, where they have a branch of researchers who are doing mathematical oncology and working hand in hand with the clinicians. And so I'm really excited that some of the models that we are creating could eventually be used in that way. And so there are some initiatives at USC and the School of Engineering and really more broadly, too, that's aiming to do that, right? To bring the data and the analysis to the clinicians in a way that's useful for them. And I would hope that in 10 years or 15 years, we would have multiple examples of models that were originated in my lab that have the type of impact that I think that is necessary and could be beneficial to lots of patients.
It's just fascinating what you do. Obviously, we only got a nibble of it because we didn't get
it. I have backup slides.
Right? It's the iceberg effect, right? Like, we can see the iceberg sticking out of the water, but there's a lot going on there.
So much we could talk about.
So much. And it's just, I mean, it's fascinating. We could, obviously, there's always levels of depth to go. But for individuals, so some of the people listening are going to take this and go, that was interesting. And it'll be added to their Rolodex in their head of things, and maybe they'll bring it up at a dinner party. Some of the people listening will be like, man, that was so interesting, and I have somebody in my life who died of cancer, and I'd love to learn more, and I want to maybe read some of the popular science things that have been written about this work. And then there are going to be other people listening who are like, ooh, maybe one day I could work in this lab. So across the board, how can people who are listening right now learn more about what you do?
Sure. So I have a website. Mm-hmm. So my lab is called the Computational Systems Biology Lab at USC. So our website is csbl.usc.edu. And so there are some videos there. You can look at our papers that we've published, just get sort of a download of what we do and go into as much depth and detail as you want. Also on my website, I talk about the outreach that I have at the 32nd Street School. You can see the students, the diversity of students who are in my lab. And so I think that's the first place to go for more information. And then the School of Engineering. So the School of Engineering at USC is the Viterbi School. And so it's viterbischool.usc.edu. And they also have, some news articles about some of the work that we've done. We got a recent grant from NIH. And in that way, it's, I think, more understandable and more easily digestible to a broader audience. There's lots of information about me online, which is scary, but good. I welcome emails. I welcome questions. I'm happy to host people in the lab over the summer. I think it's really important for people to know, I think, more broadly what academics do, and then more specifically about the work that we do in my lab.
And are you on social media at all?
I am, yes. So I don't even know if I can remember my Twitter handle.
Are you bigger on Twitter or Facebook?
Twitter?
Yes. Yeah. Okay, cool.
So it's like USC Cis Bio Lab.
Nice, nice.
And so you can see where I'm giving talks around the country, some of our latest papers I will highlight and tweet out, and then other things that are happening in our School of Engineering or other, you know, collaborators and researchers that I'm connected with.
Very cool. And if you search Stacy Finley on Twitter, Stacy with an E, on Twitter, it's the first thing that pops up, the Computational Perfect. Systems Biology Laboratory at USC. So at USC SysBio underscore lab. And I'll link that out in the show notes. Well, Stacy, okay. Thank you so much. This was just fascinating.
Thanks. This was a great conversation.
Absolutely. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.